This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming tonight. It's great to see so many people in the audience. My name is Matt Tinkler. I'm the Director of Policy and International Programs at Save the Children Australia. And I'm thrilled to be here tonight at this exceptionally important event to discuss the rate of removal of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their families and what we can do about it. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of this land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, pay my respects to any elders past or present. I'd like to acknowledge them as part of the oldest continuing culture on earth, and I'd also like to acknowledge all those people fighting for the rights of First Nations people here in Australia and overseas. So why are we here tonight and what are we going to discuss? Well, when Kevin Rudd as Prime Minister handed down his historic apology to the Stolen Generations in 2008, he resolved that this Parliament wanted to see a future where the injustices of the past must never ever happen again. So how are we tracking against that pledge made by our Prime Minister at the time? I'm proud to be here as an organisation that's part of Family Matters, a campaign that's being run by SNAIC, the peak organisation for Indigenous children in Australia. As Save the Children, we made a decision last year to focus our efforts in advocating for the rights of Indigenous people behind this campaign. And I think SNAIC's done a fantastic job at organising over 150 Indigenous organisations, NGOs and other peak bodies around the country behind this important issue. So Kevin Rudd made that pledge. But as the Family Matters report card that was released last year told us, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children continue to be significantly overrepresented in the child protection system at a rate of almost 10 times that of non-Indigenous children. And in the past 10 years, this has increased by almost 22%. So we're getting worse in this space. And last year, that report card I mentioned, the inaugural report card for Family Matters, revealed that the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children sleeping away from their homes is almost 17,000 children. And what's worse, it's on track to triple if we don't do anything about it by 2035. So the Family Matters campaign is about raising awareness to this issue and examining some of the barriers to reducing that rate of removal and discussing what some of the solutions might be. And I'm thrilled to be here, joined here tonight by our esteemed panel who are going to debate these issues for us. And let me introduce them for you. First on my left, Professor Muriel Bamblett is a proud Yorta Yorta and Jarjarong woman and one of Australia's leading experts on Aboriginal child welfare. She's been the Chief Executive Officer of the Victorian Aboriginal Childcare Agency since 1999. Muriel's long been a passionate advocate for having Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people engaged and involved in issues that affect them, and she's worked tirelessly to ensure that children in these communities maintain a strong connection with their community and culture. She was awarded a Member of the Order of Australia in 2004, and we're thrilled that she's here with us tonight, so thank you, Muriel. You may have heard Muriel this morning on John Fain debating some of these issues as well. Next, I'd like to introduce Andrew Jacquemos, who'll be known to many of you. Andrew is a proud Yorta Yorta man and was appointed in July 2013 as the inaugural Commissioner for Aboriginal Children and Young People in Victoria. And as Commissioner, Andrew's responsible for advocating for and overseeing the provision of services to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, particularly the most vulnerable in the areas of child protection, youth justice and homelessness. So please welcome Andrew and thanks for joining us tonight. And last but not least, Natalie Lewis. Thanks for coming down from Queensland, Natalie. Natalie's a descendant of the Gamilaroi Nation and is currently the CEO of the Queensland Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Child Protection Peak. Over the past 20 years, Natalie has been working in and involved in the areas of youth justice, child protection and providing direct service program and policy development and organisational leadership in both Queensland and the US. She's currently the co-chair of SNAIC and the Family Matters campaign and also holds an appointment on the Queensland Domestic and Family Violence Implementation Council. Thank you, and ladies and gentlemen, please welcome me. Join me in welcoming these esteemed speakers tonight. So, So our format for this evening, we're going to have a conversation with our panellists to begin with. Then we're going to have a bit of a Q&A session, including from you in the audience. So please get your questions ready and we'll come to you later in the program. But I'm going to start with Muriel, if that's mm-hmm. okay. And Muriel, you've worked in this sector for a long time. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can take us through a little bit of the history of this issue and explain to us why it is that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children are being removed at a higher rate than their non-Indigenous peers.
Yeah, I think having been employed at VACA now for 19 years, I've seen a lot of changes. But previously, you know, and consecutively, I guess, being on the chair of the Secretariat for National Aboriginal Islander Childcare, what we've seen, you know, is the funding of ACCAs, and so the Aboriginal childcare agencies were, you know, started out of the Commonwealth, and so the Commonwealth, and it was the era, the Whitlam era, and so Aboriginal Islander childcare agencies were established during that time, and so over the years we've seen a lot of those organisations go, and so they no longer exist. So in Queensland they had Mount Isa, they had Cairns, in Yatika and Cairns, and so Palm Island, a lot of organisations are up there, in New South Wales, Redfern. So a lot of those organisations don't exist anymore, and so the Commonwealth has withdrawn from the funding. But you still see Aboriginal and Islander child welfare as being driven by Aboriginal communities, and you know, we've got to acknowledge people like Aunty Molly Dyer, who established VACA, the organisation I work for, and their commitment, and you know, like people like Save the Children and other organisations that have supported us over the years. But, you know, back to your question about why so many Aboriginal children in out-of-home care, I think the issue is clearly, you know, related to poverty, the level of disadvantage that Aboriginal communities experience. And a lot of our people, you know, came off missions and reserves and fitting into different societies. And so we still have a lot of people that are transitioning off reserves and missions that are coming to live in Victoria and so adapting, and so they come to the attention of child protection. But if you look at the stats, 88% of children in care in Victoria are for family violence, drug and alcohol, mental health. And so, you know, have we got an approach to drug and alcohol, poverty and neglect? No, we don't. So it's quite obvious that, you know, those are the big issues that we need to be able to address.
Yeah, and one of the, aside from the startling statistics that we saw in the Family Matters report card last year, one of the things that really shocked me was that the stats revealed that the bias or the discrimination in the system seems to get worse at every stage. So not only were Indigenous children more likely to be the subject of a notification, but then they were even more likely again to be removed from their family, and even more likely again to be the subject of a permanency order. Yep. Why is the system reacting in this way? What's behind that?
I think that, you know, internationally, we know that children of colour are more likely to end up in the system. But the data over the years has never changed. The further into the system, the further the overrepresentation. So, you know, you can put it down to systemic racism, you can put it down to systemic bias, but many workers in child protection don't know how to work with Aboriginal communities, don't know how to do the work around reunification, don't know how to find family, don't know how to look for family when returning children. So we have a system often that works against Aboriginal families, and so a lot of our work has been, and I think there's been a lot of change in accepting that Aboriginal culture is resilience, it's treatment, you know, and it's important that we have the capacity to be able to, you know, work with our Aboriginal families to be able to address some of those really big issues. In Victoria, we've got the Royal Commission into Family Violence. A number of our recommendations have come out, and a lot of the funding will go to Aboriginal services. Now we've got to really put into practice the fact that we can be self-determining and we can bring about real outcomes to change, to, you know, change the trajectory for Aboriginal children.
Thank you. And Andrew, if I can go to you now, perhaps, you know, we talk about the discrimination in the system. You're someone who works within the system as an advocate for Aboriginal children. How do you use your role in Victoria to advocate for their rights within that system? And how does it work around the country in comparison to the work you do?
So I would just say, where we are right here now is really central to a whole lot of rich cultural places in Melbourne. And places that that acknowledges our leaders and people who have fought for our rights. You know, up the hill we've got the William Cooper Justice Centre, the only courthouse in Australia that is recognised as an Aboriginal leader. Mm. Up the hill here, we have statues in Parliament Gardens that acknowledge Uncle Doug and Sir Auntie Gladys Nichols, champions for rights for children and families. Down this way, we've got Berong Ma that acknowledges and Koori Heritage Trust. Up at the museum this way, we've got a rich cultural centre. These are rich centres that all our children should know. These are leaders in our community over many years. And sadly, the majority of our children in the out-of-home care system wouldn't know these things. They wouldn't have these experiences. And in some ways, that sums up how I see my job and in playing out, ensuring that all our children in out-of-home care have these opportunities to know and to be rich in culture, to know the genealogies, to know who they are, who their people. I started in this job 4 years ago. It's an independent. It's the only commissioner for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children in the nation. It's the only independent commissioner for Aboriginal children. And as I do my work, I wonder what happened before this position I'm in, that I'm privileged to be in, existed. I think we almost get the majority of concerns, calls that come into the Commission for Children and Young People in Victoria are in respect of Koori kids. Yet our children make up 20%, but a significant number of the calls come in for our children, and they're from kin, they're from grandparents, they're from uncles and aunties and siblings looking for their kids. I see my job as working in, albeit it's independent, but very much working in collaboration with the Aboriginal community sector, with VACA, with Aboriginal community-controlled organisations across the state, working in with government, both DHHS, the Child Protection, and Youth Justice, because my job is to advocate for all Aboriginal children, particularly vulnerable children and those in the youth justice system and those in the child protection system. And we know there's significant synergies between child protection and youth justice. But it's very much, I was fortunate that I was the first person in the job, so I very much, I think, crafted the job to fit my background. I grew up in a household that was rich in culture, rich in love, and rich in social justice. And can I say, the great majority of Koori kids in Victoria, and I would say nationally, are growing up in strong families that love, in which there's love, culture, aspirations, go to school. And I see my job coming every day to ensure that all our kids have those same cultures, have those opportunities. And I see that through the great privilege I have, being independent and reporting to Parliament, and being able to provide a individual commentary. I'm not here to keep government happy. I'm not here to keep community organisations happy. I'm here to work in partnership to get the best deal for our kids. It's a great opportunity in 5 years to do that. But I can see what was missing when I took this job, and I just wonder what's happening in the other jurisdictions. We absolutely have to have independent commissioners with powers to undertake own motion inquiries, to work in partnership. They need to be resourced to be able to do it in every jurisdiction. And in some ways it's saddened that it's not there, but I think there's great potential for us to push for it.
And so you've been in the role now 4 years, and I know you've released a number of compelling reports. How have you found that those reports have been received by government and others, and how are they responding?
I think they've been excellently received by community, by government, across the sector, interstate. The government has accepted all the 133 recommendations contained in both reports, Always Was, Always Will Be Koori Children, and In the Child's Best Interest, about the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle. They've accepted all of them, in part, in principle, in full. And the great thing is we're working, the Commission is working in partnership with community sector organisations, government, and with Mr Makakos, to work to implement those. We have a great partnership arrangement, so I'm quite proud of the work we're doing in Victoria. We have a long, long way to go, but that's one, I believe it's a strong self-determination principles underlie that work. You know, there's great work, but we have a lot of kids and increasing numbers of our children in our home care, so...
So, Natalie, can I come to you next? And I heard John Fain ask Muriel this question this morning around funding, and the suggestion being that there is a lot of money in the system already and funding may not be the answer. But my question for you is, do we have money invested at the right parts of the system, or are we investing at the proverbial ambulance at the bottom of the cliff in the child protection system and not enough in preventative measures to keep children safe and strong in their communities and culture?
Yeah, look, it's certainly not it's not a resource issue in terms of the quantum of investment. When we hear the figures, the billions of dollars that are invested in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander issues or industry or whatever people would like to label it, but it certainly is an issue about the distribution and the effectiveness of that investment. So what we see nationally is that about 17% of the investment is actually towards prevention and early intervention. The rest, the 83%, let me make sure my math is right, is actually in the tertiary end of the system. And it's a really bad business model because, I mean... that amount of investment, and year after year after year, the outcomes are far worse. All Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children that are in out-of-home care experience higher rates of homelessness, experience higher rates of mental health issues, lower educational attainment, poorer health outcomes. So as an investment model, why does it make sense to continue to invest such a massive proportion of that expenditure in a system that is failing our children? So I think that it's more an issue of trying to get some type of, recalibrating that investment so that more of the money is actually put into working in prevention and early interventions, trying to establish, equitable access for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and families in universal services, working in issues such as domestic and family violence, which, nationally we know is an issue, and it disproportionately impacts Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities as well. So, I think it's definitely a distribution of resources issue. And the other side of that is that very, it irritates me when we hear, this discussions about, the Aboriginal industry and there's so much money, and it's this assumption that somehow all of those billions of dollars make their way into Aboriginal pockets, and that is so not the case. At least in Queensland, I know only 6% of the investment is actually directed towards Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community-controlled organisations. The rest is actually tied up in government administration or in the service provision that is not working in larger non-government organisations and faith-based organisations that have a footprint in our communities in the same way that that missions did historically.
And I know some governments are trying innovative funding models. So in Queensland, I read that there's a social impact bond that's being directed to try and reunify children who've been removed from their families back into family and culture. Do you think those funding models can work?
That's again a tertiary investment, and sometimes it's not about requiring dollars. It's actually about trusting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations and professionals to do what they do best. For example, we have a program called the Recognised Entity in Queensland, which is sort of this cultural advice type of role. Now, if government were to sort of let go of the reins a little bit and say, well, you have some autonomy and some independent sort of, you know, discretion around decision-making, when that's been allowed to happen, those organisations have been able to identify alternative placements within the child's kinship structure, and in many cases have actually found family and enabled reunification, you know, to their families from the tertiary system, which actually over the space of even just one quarter, with seven of those children, you know, being reunified in one quarter in one particular region, there was a return, there was a saving to government of nearly $500,000. So that was not about extra dollars. That was about trusting Aboriginal people to do what they can do. Mm. Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if I can ask the panel generally a question now, a fundamental question, I think, around the campaign, and that is, why is culture so important, which is really the objective of the campaign? Why is it so meaningful, and what does it mean to you?
for me... culture is the greatest. Culture and education, for me, are the two of the greatest resilient factors we can give our children. You know, if we're going to make a change, for me, culture and education are critical to it happening. And let me say, culture isn't just about shake a leg and language. It's about how we greet each other. It's about our responsibilities to each other. It's about knowing your genealogy. It's who you are, where you fit in the structure, what are your social responsibilities to your kin, to your siblings. And these provide children a structure, a place in their community, in their family. And without that, you know, we know that, you know, 66 of the 99 deaths in custody reviewed by the Royal Commission were of children who were taken away from family. You know, culture is critical to your image of self, who you are, where you fit into it. And for me, without having that solid foundation, then it undermines the rest of your future.
So we use culture as treatment, so when working with children. So Dr. Bruce Perry came out, and he's well-known in working with trauma. And what he found that we need to be able to engage with children on different levels. And so we use culture through the possum skin cloak making. And so the children work with aunties and uncles, and they make a possum skin cloak. And some of the stories that come through from children going through their trauma stories and what they've been through. And I think it's really important that, you know, it's not only a treatment, but it is, as Andrew spoke about, it's about resilience, it's about protection, and it also is about their rights. But what we know in the research, it says, and, you know, Canada's done a lot of work in this, and what they found that children, as they go through life, a two-year-old may not care about their culture. But by the time they're 6 to 7, they're becoming very inquisitive. And in the system, what we find is most of our placements break down in adolescence. And that's because kids go looking for their culture. They know they're different, they know they're Aboriginal, but they want to know who they are. They want to know where they come from. And if we don't have systems that are about doing that, but, you know, next week we celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Bringing Them Home report. And it, one of the things that they talked about, that children have rights to their native title, that they have rights to connection and their heritage. And so it's important that we in child welfare, that we keep doing that work. And so we do genealogies, we issue Aboriginality for children, and that then identifies them with their land. But if it's really hard to sort of put across to people how important culture is to children, but I just want to touch on a very brief story. We had a 14-year-old, and people have heard this lots of time, But we had a 14-year-old and he was living in the East, and we were having really lots of issues with him. He was quite traumatic and behavioural issues and been through a lot of trauma. He came from Framlingham Mission, and what happened was we had a very strong Aboriginal man who was taking him back to do a return to country. When he was taking him down in the car, he said, "I felt like putting him out on the side of the road a couple of times." He was, you know, them Aborigines, and he was talking really derogatory about Aboriginal, and he was so disconnected. When he got down there, what he did is he actually got him to take his shoes off, and he said, "I want you to feel this is your land, this is your country, this is where you come from." But he was all, Uncle Banjo Clark was alive at the time, and Uncle Banjo took him around and told him how his what his people had done, how they contributed, and that they were heroes. And this young fella, his chest was puffing out, and when he got, you know, in the car coming back, he said, "My people, my land, my culture." The importance of culture, you know, it is a connector. It is about resilience. And so you can't underestimate how important it is for children. Mm. You know, and I think we have systems that think that giving a boomerang to a child is connecting, but it's much, much more than that. And I think it's about really the most important thing, gift that we can give in child welfare is children's culture.
And given that importance, and Natalie, maybe I'll come to you on this one, how do we balance that, that obviously the crucial nature of that connection to culture and community with what's in the best interest of a child, where they may be in a situation where they may be at risk of neglect or their safety's at risk? How do we balance those rights versus that right and the importance of maintaining the connection to culture?
Yeah, look, I think it's, you know, there's a sort of discourse that emerges in the media from time to time, you know, where it's assumed or at least presented that it's an either-or proposition, you know. And look, there, I've never come across anyone that we've worked with through this campaign that isn't absolutely clear on the fact that the safety of our children is absolutely paramount. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children have the same entitlement and right to be safe as every other Australian child. So there's no argument about it, you know, being pushed aside on a, you know, to make someone feel good about themselves, you know, about making a decision or fearing that if they make a decision that a child needs to be removed, that they're somehow going to be labelled a racist. The thing is, if a child needs to be removed in order to secure their immediate safety, that doesn't negate that their child also has a right to cultural continuity. So we need to make sure that the processes and supports are in place to make sure that that first placement is the right placement, that we've explored options to be able to find family members within that child's kinship structure that we can support to enable that child to, you know, continue their connection to culture. There's, you know, once children are in the system and they've experienced that disconnection, I'm yet to really find a jurisdiction that does this particularly well, where we actually are continually going back and working with family to try and work towards reunification, because it becomes almost like a placement management where we kind of put the cultural needs on the shelf because it's inconvenient or, you know, or because it's a little bit too hard. And so we need to make sure that we are using every available resource and opportunity to ensure that child's cultural continuity.
Yeah, and I was sort of drawing on my inner Andrew Bolt a little bit with that question, but it is one that gets asked. And, you know, when we were in Canberra last year, Muriel, walking the halls of Parliament, some very senior politicians there, immediate question was, what about parental responsibility? Yes. Where does that come in this equation? So how do you think we're best to respond as people concerned about this issue when that question gets raised?
I think all of us would say that we never, ever put a child's safety at risk, and most communities would not do that. And I think there's it's totally disrespectful to say that we would, you know, place a child at risk. But if we don't consider cultural risk as well and cultural disconnection, then we have a huge amount of children that are ending up in the juvenile justice system, in the criminal justice system. And they're basically walking around in the Netherlands because they can't connect. They can't connect because they don't fit into a Western construct. They don't fit into Aboriginal because they've been raised away. I mean, the way that I connect with Andrew is when the first thing I say to him is, who's your mob? Where are you from? Mm-hmm. We start to connect through our language, our songs, our ceremonies, our talking. And so for a child not to be able to do that, we're not the only first peoples that have this issue. You know, you see it in Canada, you see it in other countries, but other countries are protected through treaties and agreements. We don't have treaties or agreements here, and so we're sort of basically at the whim of government, so we have to wait until somebody, you know, recognises or is good to us or sees us as merit. And this issue of, you know, parental responsibility, it tells parents to pull their socks up. Well, what happens if you haven't got any socks on in the first place?
Yeah.
You know, take responsibility for your actions when you're living in poverty. Everything's wrong. You've never, ever had a good role model. You've been raised by an institution. So I think there's a lot of things that we, you know, really need to be able to empower communities. But I think that our families have the, you know, solutions, and they want us to work with them on it.
I think we just need you, Muriel, on hand if Andrew Bolt asks that question again. So I want to ask you a little bit about, and Andrew, maybe you can comment on the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle and permanency orders. And I'm an ex-lawyer, and it feels like to me that there's a point in the system where permanency orders are made that's the point where a link to community and culture can almost be extinguished for life for an Indigenous child. Do we need a moratorium on these orders, or how do we respond to that, the way the legal system is acting at the moment?
I think it's... and probably we need to go back a few places. We need to do more about investing in early intervention, prevention, building strong families. But even before then, we need to be working with our children about what's healthy and healthy and strong and safe relationships. I think that's the work we need to be doing. We need to be working with our young families before children are removed. But if we come to that point in time where children do have to be removed, we do need to go to the Aboriginal Child Placement and ensure that those children are placed in safe in safe placements with family. So the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle isn't just about placement. It's about the Aboriginal community's involvement in the process. It's about including the Aboriginal community before a child's removed, about having those discussions. And even before, it's about Aboriginal community being involved in the policy development, in the frameworks around it. In Victoria, I think roughly 91% of our children are placed outside of community, and I find that particularly distressing. Distressing that I know that many of those children, through those placements, will be lost. Majority will come home, but I feel sorry that there are kin out there who are waiting to provide safe places, who can connect them with country, with genealogies, with their ancestors. And this is all possible if we do the right thing. So in my reviews, I didn't find much wrong with legislation, and I didn't find much wrong with programs. It's about practice. It's about we do the right thing. It's about ensuring, and I believe that all our children should... that are unfortunately removed are with place with community, because I believe that our community know culture best. We know our community. We know kinship structures, family, community structures, clan structures. We have this information, and we are best. You know, when we did our work, Task Force 1000, coinciding with that was a marked increase in reunifications of children going home, and this wasn't as a result of change programs or legislation. It's about doing practice better.
Mm. And I want to come to the audience in a moment, so get your questions ready. Mm-hmm. But before I do, I just wanted to ask the panel about the role of governments. And one of the key asks of the Family Matters campaign is a national COAG target, a Close the Gap target, and also a COAG strategy to reduce the rate of removal of Indigenous children from their families. How important is it that we have leadership from a federal government level, or is this more a state and territory government responsibility?
I think in Victoria we enjoy quite a lot more in as far as rights, as far as commitment, and it still doesn't go far enough. But when you look at other states and territories, and particularly the Northern Territory, if you ever get a chance, look at the Commissioner's reports that they put out every year. They paint the worst picture of the worst types of crisis and abuse, and nobody picks it up, and it's just business as usual. So we know that in across Australia, you know, children's rights are being abused. Children are, you know, ending up in terrible situations, and we aren't able to address it. And I think that, you know, I have, you know, in my role as chair of SNAIC for 10 years, we banged on the door of so many politicians, but it was, oh, that's the state's responsibility. And so it was always, and, you know, now we see the multifunctional Aboriginal children's services, you know, the children's centres being closed down, a lack of, you know, changing the funding models for those services. We're in a really, you know, dangerous time in that, you know, we should be investing more, not taking away, and looking at how do we fund those services to deliver really some of those critical services. Because in 2009-10, I did the Northern Territory Inquiry, and what we saw was really great examples of communities doing things on a very small budget. But they did them for a period of time. They got funding for government for a period of time, you know, and they were pilots, and so they didn't fund them. And so I think that we do need to have national. I think we need to have national standards around Aboriginal children. I think that we need to advocate for all children. We do enjoy in Victoria a commitment. We've got, you know, conversations happening around treaty, around self-determination. We've got a, you know, premier that's saying that he's willing to talk to Aboriginal people, and so we see, you know, funding at the moment for return to country. We've never seen that in any state or territory. We see now cultural support planning, you know, dollars invested in child welfare to improve those things. But that's not a standard across the country. So SNAIC's saying that AFLDM, which is, you know, including Aboriginal people in key decision-making in child protection, as a model that works. Well, that's only in Victoria, and some of the other states do it to a certain degree. But why don't we have national standards? Why can't we get COAG to agree? And I think that there are states at various stages, and I think that we need to pursue it much more aggressively. But we do need to have our partners, and we need to have communities standing behind us. And that's why I'm, you know, really pleased that, you know, you've been there with us and using your connections in Parliament to get us in the doors of some people, but we do need other people to stand up and help us. Yeah.
All right. I might go to the audience and ask for some questions. If you do have a question, if you can stand up, give us your name and where you're from. Try and make sure you do ask a question and not make a statement. If you do, I will Tony Jones you and take it as a comment. But I'm sure we have some questions out there, so would anyone like to kick us off?
I'm a non-Indigenous carer of a young Indigenous boy, and I guess I'm lucky in a lot of ways because I worked up in the Northern Territory with Indigenous people. I was adopted into a family there. I spent a lot of time there. So I understand maybe more than a lot of people about having that connection to country and culture. My question is, since I've been doing this, we've had no, training or anything around working with Indigenous youth. So given that kids are always going to be put with, well, not always, but yeah, hopefully kinship care where it can be, but children are going to be put with non-Indigenous carers, is there maybe something like a course or something that carers can do so that they understand it, how to go about providing the best cultural opportunities for the kids that they have in their care, if that makes sense?
It does. Great question to start us off, I think. So who'd like to have a go at answering that one?
We run training at the Victorian Aboriginal Childcare Agency for carers for non-Aboriginal carers of Aboriginal children, because we really think it's important to, you know, be able to engage, because foster carers to us are like gold. I mean, everybody cuts each other's throats to get a carer, because we all know that once you get a carer, you really need to look after them, and they do a job with very little, you know, funding, so it's just cost for the child, so they don't actually get paid to do the work. So I'm happy to have a conversation with you about what training we offer, but it's not training that's offered all over the country. So it's only offered here in Victoria.
And how is the take-up of that kind of training? Or is it?
We get a lot of interest in it. And what the training does is it actually uses the best interest principles in Victoria. And it has an exercise where it looks at, if you had honoured the best interests of a child, what would be the things that you would put? And so people talk about stability and, you know, having good schooling, education. And then we do an exercise where we talk to the carers and go through what are the cultural needs. And so then we put another picture of another child, and we actually say, if you were to meet the cultural needs, what would be the things that you would meet for an Aboriginal child? And so connection to land and having access to, you know, sort of an Aboriginal health service. And so they put all these. And then we say, we put the two, you know, pictures up. And so we say, well, if you do all of these things around stability and all of that, does that meet the child's needs? And people look over here at all these cultural issues and they say, no. So if we say, we do all these cultural things, does that meet all their needs? People go, no. But if you put the two of them together, it's not an either or. Best interests and cultural needs do mix. And so a lot of our work is really working with carers, and they love it. The issue that carers have is that they become our carers, and then when they become permanent carers, they're to go off our books. And a lot of carers say to us that they miss the support, and they miss having an Aboriginal person be able to stay in their lives and connection to us. So I think that that's the critical issue, that is the long-term ability to be able to stay connected to non-Aboriginal carers. Mm.
And
One of the recommendations that state government's funded from our inquiry was the establishment of a portal, online portal, which VACA is developing for us, and that will be a resource for carers and the children themselves to actually go on to have a look at cultural activities, community activities that are happening statewide. So it's still in development, but for me, I see that as an important resource for carers, both Koori, non-Koori, to access.
Mm. And Natalie, are there things happening in other jurisdictions?
You know, in Queensland, there is virtually no support in terms of working with non-Indigenous carers to, improve their capability in raising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children that are connected. And, when you're applying as a foster carer in Queensland, there's really just one reference that asks if you're prepared to look after an Aboriginal child. And so and the CEO of the Peak body there, and one of the things that we're advocating is that as we progress through the hierarchy of the child placement principle, if it comes to a situation where there is the placement option is a non-Indigenous carer, then that there be a positive obligation put back on the department to ensure that they are provided with the supports that they require, that they are connected with a requisite cultural authority to ensure that they have they are provided with the opportunities to understand where that child is connected and how they can best facilitate that. So, but at the moment it is just sort of are you happy to look after an Aboriginal child, not do you have the demonstrated sort of capacity or capability to do so, in an authentic way?
Yeah. Mm. So thank you for that question, and thanks for the work you do as a carer, and it sounds like there are some supports out there. Do we have another question for the panel?
Hi, I'm Gary, and I'm Cookie Allenge from Cape York. I have a couple of different hats in my life. One of them is a director for Save the Children, and also I'm the CEO for National Congress of Australia's First People. next week we've got 300 people meeting at Uluru to talk about treaty. And one thing that hasn't been talked about is the provision of services to our communities and our peoples. Do you see that there is a role for the conversation to happen with the magic 300 that have been chosen? Or will we wait until, you know, there's the voice comes through Family Matters and through the Redfern statement for the COAG reform, which mightn't occur until late next year?
I'm on the interim working group for the treaty here in Victoria, and so really sort of been really keen because we've been looking at other countries where they have treaties, and so the Waitangi Treaty, they're in their fifth iteration of developing it, and what a lot of countries have learned that if you don't have the services included, then you're missing a big proportion of, you know, people and where people access. So I've been really keen to be involved to make sure that there's protection for what we're, you know, particularly a lot of the programs and services that we're now getting. And, you know, Andrew's talked about, you know, the Commission, all of these things could go with different governments. So we're really keen to look at the treaty process to be able to protect what good work is and commit to an ongoing process. So we're really keen to get bipartisan support to some of the agreements, to the Aboriginal Children's Forum, to a lot of the cultural work that we've been doing. So it's having a number of approaches and not just having, you know, doing it, I guess, through, you know, our policy work, but also engaging government and bipartisan. And so the treaty process at the moment, it's very exciting. We're, you know, sort of looking at the representative structure. But the Victorian government does want to put a treaty into its state legislation, so they're working to that. We're yet to see how the Victorian government or the Victorian public react to that, but certainly we've got a Premier that's prepared to do it.
And what about the national level? Do we hold out any hope of a national treaty, and how important is the issue of constitutional recognition that's being debated at the moment?
I think having terrible English, isn't it? Having spoken to Pat Anderson, she, you know, is really sort of who's co-chair of constitutional recognition. She's not pinning it all on constitutional recognition. She really does want, and she's hearing the voice of Aboriginal people, and each state and territory are all saying the same thing: we want a treaty. Pat's really trying to get people to be engaged in constitutional recognition. She thinks that's a good pre-step towards treaty. But I think that most of the 300 people that'll be going there will be talking about treaty. It is about constitutional recognition, but I know that there is a broader agreement and people want a treaty. Yeah. And I think that it'll be a very grown-up government that can honour its commitment to its first people that will enter into a treaty agreement, because there's nothing to lose. I mean, we already have agreements or treaties here in Victoria through heritage, you know, through native title, and Victoria, nobody's a loser in Victoria. We already have treaties, so with first peoples.
Tim, if I could say, answer Gary further, is that I don't think it's ever too late to have children on the agenda, particularly, and I think earlier the better for treaty, so that they're right there at the heart of it. And you know, as Muriel said, you know, governments come and go, and you know, I would love to see agreements around children locked into treaty.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the floor? Yes.
Yes, I just wonder, I'm not really quite sure why so many children are going to non-Indigenous families for care, when they're considered to be not being cared for in the existing family. Is it because the Indigenous families are not being recognised on a community basis? That is, they're not meeting some other standard that is coming from a mainly white community rather than community care. I'm not quite sure why the children are not being placed within the Indigenous area in their own culture.
So I might start. The Commission undertook an inquiry that we tabled in Parliament in October last year called In a Child's Best Interest, which we looked at the compliance with the intent of the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle here in Victoria. And we saw significant failures and opportunities to improve it. You know, we saw where we have vital programs and policies that are in place as delivered by VACA and by Mallee District Aboriginal Services up in along the river, where Aboriginal community organisations, parties are required to be notified right at the very start of where child protection comes into contact. And it's right at that point in time where we start to make contacts to look at family, kin, to look at options. Also, before children are removed, what we saw was that there have been failures and continue to be failures with the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle being enacted. And we've made significant recommendations, and there is significant work also underway to address those practice failures. For me, there are a whole range of reasons. There's also people, a lot of potential carers aren't being considered. And also that, you know, in part that could be about past intergenerational trauma involved with the child protection systems. But also I see there has been in the past, and some work that we're working on about institutional bias and racism.
And what about institutions, Andrew? A lot of NGOs, community organisations are providing out-of-home care places, effectively, you know, institutional care. What can NGOs do to help increase the number of kinship places, culturally appropriate care?
Oh, I think it's about... That's a whole lot of answers there. Mm. One is about the workforce. One about ensuring that you have a Koori-friendly workforce that understands why we have the principle. One is about ensuring that people ask the question. You know, one of the things I picked up in Task Force 1000, our work, was where child protection workers said to me across the state that they didn't ask whether the child was Aboriginal, was they didn't want to embarrass the parents. But if you don't ask the question, then the critical services that VACA provides, that MDAS, Mallee District provides about those family connections don't come into play. And if we don't ask the question, then the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle doesn't happen. The child doesn't get an Aboriginal cultural care plan. And a lot of times we see this not happening for years. It's about ensuring and both government and community sector organisations ensuring we ask the question. It's about having it's about ensuring that there is the management responsibility in place and the message comes from high up in the NGOs that it is critical about the Aboriginal Child Placement Principle, we ask the question.
And I think fundamentally, sorry, Annie Muriel, fundamentally I think when I look at the Queensland context, what that comes down to is just a lack of participation. And participation is one of the core elements of the Child Placement Principle. So when we talk about participation at just that, at a sort of family case level decision making sort of space, there is no one more invested in the outcomes for that child than that child's family. They may be struggling at a point in time, experiencing vulnerability, but there is no one more invested. But yet they're often the ones that are sidelined in the process of making decisions. So I think that when we can really focus on increasing sort of the participation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the decisions that most profoundly impact their children, I think then we'll start to see a massive shift in things like compliance with the Child Placement Principle and better decision making, you know, and a safer system.
Other questions from the audience? Yes, this one over here.
Hi, my name's Sue Beecher. I've been connected with SNAKE for over a decade, so firstly, thank you all for this really interesting evening. My question is, what's the take-home message for everyone in this audience tonight? What is it that they can do, because there's a lot of people in this room, around the Family Matters campaign? If there was one thing that you would like to pass on to the audience, what would it be from each of you? Thanks.
Sure, Natalie, why don't we start with you on that one?
Okay. So first of all, would be to make sure you visit the website, where we've outlined a number of strategies that people can utilise to try and effect change in this space. The goal of the campaign is to eliminate overrepresentation within a generation. So we need people to be mobilised at an individual level, at a community level, and importantly, those of you that are here that work for organisations that have a stake in this sector. We would love to see people signing up to the statement of commitment and really paying attention to the six principles that are outlined in that statement, because we need to give life to those. It's not a statement you sign just to feel good about for 5 minutes. It's something that we need individuals, communities and organisations to commit to if we're going to get anywhere near that goal of eliminating overrepresentation. So I think there's about five things, but yeah. Website first.
And while there's so many beautiful, affluent people here, I would also like to ask you to consider about considering yourselves as potential foster carers, respite carers. If you can't commit full-time, part-time, respite, but also, and it's not, I know VACA would consider the great diversity of families being potential carers.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Of course we do.
Yes.
And Muriel, any other takeaway messages for you, for the audience?
I think that the take-home message has to be that Aboriginal children don't just belong to Aboriginal people. You know, Aboriginal children are First Nations, we're First Peoples, and something to be proud of. Mm. And I think that we want our children to have a heritage that's built on being proud to identify as Aboriginal. And we don't want to have Aboriginal children growing up not knowing who they are, where they come from, or being ashamed of being an Aboriginal. Don't want to tell somebody they're Aboriginal because it's something to be ashamed of. And so the take-home message obviously would be to get behind and, you know, and support Aboriginal people wherever you know, wherever they be, and to be able to lift Aboriginal people up, because for so long we've been held down. And I think, you know, so many people have done for us, and now we're starting to do for ourselves, and to support us to do that. Yeah.
So thanks for that question. I think we've got time for perhaps one more question. I know there is a hand up down the front here if there's not another one already lined up. Yeah, just down the front here.
On a macro level, I happened to be in Canberra in February for the Bridging the Gap. And I essentially... The Prime Minister's response blew me away because he just ignored it. You know, when he was all he did was read out a report of six areas out of seven where they'd fallen down. There was no commitment, the fact that they were going to try and double their efforts to catch up or whatever. There was not even, the gallery was full of Indigenous people. And there wasn't even a mission of saying sorry that we failed. There was nothing. It just seemed to me that the federal government is going through the motions and really doesn't really want to bridge the gap. Mm.
So thank you. So is the federal government going through the motions on this issue?
Yeah, look, I think at its core, the Closing the Gap initiative, Family Matters, the Change the Record, other campaigns, at their core they're about fairness and equity. And that concept of fairness is something that, you know, we claim to hold really dear as a you know, national value. And what I saw I was actually there, you know, on that same day, and I saw someone feeling like they could absolve themselves from that responsibility just by virtue of talking about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, that equity and fairness is okay as a national value, but we don't need to extend that to our First Nations children. And I think that that's... I think that's what we should be pursuing, because right now the narrative for our children is, you know, is built on, you know, words like disadvantage, you know, and hopelessness. And I think we need to be able to turn that around. We have to be talking about limitless potential and a hopefulness for the future of our kids. And unfortunately, with that lack of leadership and lack of response, you know, it makes it very difficult.
I think we suffer in Australia from the fact that, you know, we had the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission, and that was in some way a leadership, but there's no one to hold government accountable. You look at all the plans, you know, all the commitments that are made to Aboriginal and never deliver on them, and we're constantly, you know, put up there as everything's bad for Aboriginal, and we're constantly blamed for the issues that we're dealing with, but we don't have any control over the decision making. We don't have any control over the policy, and when people aren't accountable, we have the same across the whole of government down here. They report on what they're doing, but they're not actually changing the dial. And so if Aboriginal people aren't in control of setting it, and some of the work that we've been doing through, you know, Minister Jenny Makakos, she meets with us in a room and she's saying, I want to shift the dial, and she's really challenging us as Aboriginal people to be able to, you know, you just don't say that things need to change, you need to change them. So we're working very hard to be able to come up with models to be able to change the dial. But for us, and, you know, it goes back to a statement, we haven't exercised our self-determination muscles for a long time, and we need to start doing it. We need to start ourselves to be able to take on and be able to do that. And that will require, but we also need a treaty, and we need a representative body, and we need an assembly that is able to drive that at a national level. I think we can't just be recipients of a service system for the rest of our life. We've got to be able to lead, and we've got to be able to challenge government.
My friend, I share your concerns. Thank you.
So it's a great call to arms to finish on. So can you please thank Natalie Lewis, Andrew Jacquemos and Maria Bamber.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.